This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit, with your host, Pat McMahon.
As welcome to The God Show. And this is a program that's been on the air for 17 years. This is just a new address for us. This is an opportunity to find out a few things about God that you might not have thought about. He will not be our guest today, but I'm sure he'll be listening. That's the kind of thing we'll discuss, by the way, every week. Why is God a he? Why not a she or the force? You see, the God Show isn't a religion show. Sometimes we'll talk about religions and the good they do, and we won't ignore the bad they do. You see, this is about God and us, you and me, men and women and children, maybe even dogs and cats. After all, they're God's creatures, aren't they? Yes, even cats. So let's have a discussion about humanity, spirituality, and the soul, if there is one. And if there is, where does it go afterwards? This is The God Show, new every week and available always on the Star Worldwide Networks. Guest that's going to kick this series off on those networks is David Felden. And we picked you, David, because you're a musician, a pastor, a video educator with a church home at the Fountains, United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona. And you're also a fun guy to talk to about this show and about your own series called Living the Questions. Nice to have you with us.
Great to be here.
After all this time, I always wonder why a guest never gets a chance to say, well, I'm here because I had no place else to go. You know, or I heard the money was good, and then I found out before it was too late and I couldn't get out of the studio.
Absolutely. And we've been together so many times now, it just seems like the thing to do.
Well, I wanted you to kick off this series, though, of God Shows, because it's Easter time all over the world, and Christians everywhere are celebrating the miracle of Jesus rising from the dead, the resurrection. And at least we can all agree on that.
Can we?
Well, I guess maybe that's one of the reasons why I asked you in particular. The tradition says that 3 days after the crucifixion, the stone in front of the tomb was rolled away, and the centurion left out of fear, and Jesus arose. And then the rest of the story, I guess, is called Christianity. Are you saying that it may not have happened exactly that way?
Well, it depends on what gospel you're reading. Because each one of the Gospels is so different, you can't really put them together into one storyline. And that's been one of the fascinating things to me as I've gone on through my ministry, is whether it's willful ignorance or whether it's just not paying attention at all, that each one of the Gospels is so different, that the stone being rolled away in the presence of centurions or angels or an angel or the women, or it's everyone is so different. And so when people come to talk about the resurrection, I say, which one?
Give us an example of how the Gospels differ.
Well, probably be a good place to start with Paul, because Paul was our earliest writer in the New Testament. He was writing in the 50s, and he's the first one to recount anything to the Corinthians, actually. He was trying to correct their misperception about the resurrection. And he said, you know, look, you're sown a physical seed, a physical body, but you're raised a spiritual body. So basically, right out of the gate, he's saying, it's not a physical resurrection. I don't care what you guys are talking about. And then come another 30 years later, 40 years later, when Mark was written, our earliest gospel, there is no appearance of Jesus after the resurrection. There's basically frightened disciples who run off and don't tell anyone anything.
Wait, okay. I was willing to buy the Paul story because he was always a troublemaker anyway.
Always.
But Matthew, are you saying that he doesn't even acknowledge that there was a resurrection?
Well, Matthew's different than Mark. You've got to keep your gospel straight. And that's part of the problem that we have when people come to church basically just for Easter and Christmas. If they're paying attention, every year they're going to get a completely different resurrection story. So, you know, someone might turn to his wife and say, Marge, last year there were two angels, and this year there's only one. What's going on here? You know, but most people don't pay that much attention. So they just are really sloppy in thinking about this. And so it becomes a very strange stew of ideas about an historical event that not even the Gospels can agree on. And yet, for many people, even if they can go so far as to say, okay, virgin birth, metaphor, lots of virgin births throughout history. But miracles, miracles, I think we can look at those metaphorically as well. But resurrection hangs on as kind of like the litmus test for whether you are a true Christian or not, to believe that there was a physical resurrection.
Because I think most Christians grow up with the fact that Easter itself, Easter week, and then the weekend with Good Friday and Holy Saturday into Easter Sunday, and the celebration of the resurrection as we have been celebrating it over the centuries, that that's the fundamental basis of Christianity. If the traditional resurrection story may not be as we've been told, well, then what becomes of the whole Christian movement?
Well, that's the word that I get from a lot of colleagues who are hard-pressed to get across a message of physical resurrection on Easter Sunday. In fact, you know, one said, wow, if I believed like you that resurrection is a metaphor for new life, I just have no reason to get up on Easter morning. It's just, there's no point. And I really have to say that for these folks, first of all, it's a lack of imagination that they can't think through these stories as the poetic metaphors that they were intended to be. If we go back, we can go point by point through each one of the Gospels, how they are dissimilar from one another in the resurrection stories. But I think one of the things we need to talk about is also what are we talking about going ahead as Christianity being centered on one amazing thing that happened, one spectacular moment 2,000 years ago, and that even against all of your best rational thought, you suspend disbelief and say that actually happened. And it's only in convincing God that you believe in this spectacular thing having happened that somehow you're acceptable to God.
Well, that has been, however, perfectly acceptable to the vast majority of Christians over the centuries and centuries and millennia that there has been a Christianity.
Well, that's not actually the case, because there have always been varieties of understandings of Christianity, many of which people only have a very tenuous awareness of. One of the things that's come around recently is the discovery of the Nag Hammadi Gospels in the desert of Egypt.
Spell that.
N-A-G-H-A-M-M-A-D-I, Nag Hammadi.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the village in which these jars were found, in which there were writings from thousands of years ago that were beautifully preserved. One of them has famously become very popular and is the Gospel of Thomas. And this is a gospel that is what's called a sayings gospel. There's no stories. There's no miracles. There's no plot in the Gospel of Thomas as we would consider the other gospels as stories.
It doesn't sound like it would be a bestseller, though.
Well, actually, it's really fascinating, and it's similar to Proverbs in Hebrew Scripture, where it's Jesus says this, Jesus says that, and in order to follow Jesus, this is a good idea. And what's amazing about that, which is early Christian writing, it may even predate some of our canonical Gospels, is that there's no crucifixion and no resurrection story. There's no virgin birth either. Because what this community believed is that what Jesus taught and what he said about the way we need to live in the world is more important than these miraculous events that we believe in somehow.
We're talking to David Felton, by the way, on The God Show. And David is an academic. David is a minister at the Fountains in Fountain Hills, which, part of the greater Valley of the Sun Phoenix area in central Arizona. I don't know that necessarily even your congregation would consider you to be a revolutionary iconoclast, but you certainly seem to be unique, and if not one of a kind, then only a handful of folks carrying this message around that makes you probably someone who is subject to threats.
Well, we've had our fair share of those, but I would say, and usually from good Christians, but I'd have to say overwhelmingly the response is positive. We talk about spiritual gifts, speaking in tongues or what have you, and my wife says that I have the spiritual gift of making 70-year-old engineers cry because someone will bring their father as a visitor and they'll hear me preach and talk about a rational, evidence-based approach to Christianity, looking historically and critically at the text, and they'll come up to me in tears and say, if I would have heard this 40 years ago, I would have never left the church.
Mm.
But I've been away because I didn't think that I could engage my mind the way I do in my career. And so it's a liberating experience. And so absolutely no agreement across the board at my church in how to interpret the totality of Christianity. But what we try to encourage is an openness and the conversation and talking about all the various ways that people interpret Christianity. And for many, it is a life-changing experience to know that they can use their mind, that they can think, and that they can be a rational human being as well as being a follower of Jesus. For one, I don't really talk about being a Christian anymore because Christianity itself just comes with so much baggage. But if we're talking about being a follower of Jesus, now that is something that is taking Jesus seriously even today, what he asked us to do as followers, what his example was for us, that is still a radical challenge in today's world.
But you are a Methodist minister. You're an academic. We have been hearing you speak on this Easter Sunday about the book of David Felton and some other folks.
Well, let me say, I'm not alone in this. There are countless others. There are lots. This is, to affirm the fears that people have about universities, polluting their children's minds. Absolutely. The academic world, for the most part, would be more where I am at on this. And I'd have to say that many of my colleagues are, but many of them also don't know how to present it to their congregation without people running from the place screaming. And I've just been very fortunate to be in congregations that have given me the opportunity to make a case and to stay with me through this. And there are examples of this all across not only the country, but the world. And I'd have to say that many of the people who are where I'm at are also like that crying engineer of whom I've had many, and they have left the church. They are integrious enough, that George Bush word, that they say, I cannot in good conscience buy into what the church is asking me to believe. And so therefore, I'm going to step away from it. And what I'm saying is, no, you don't have to step away from it, because there are multiple ways of being a follower of Jesus that doesn't ask you to compromise your intelligence.
You have a degree in divinity. You studied at Arizona State University. You also, however, did further study at an institution in Perth, Australia. And so because of the remarkable, dare I say, miraculous opportunity that people have to listen to this broadcast on Star Worldwide Networks, the opportunity that they have on the internet to be able to pick this broadcast up internationally, there's probably somebody right now listening in Adelaide, Australia, who is saying, wait a minute, this David Felton guy, this Methodist minister, or so he says, he's a Methodist minister. He's not like the Methodist ministers that I know. I wonder if David Felton actually even believes in the Bible.
Well, I think that what I would want to tell a person like that is that I don't believe in the Bible, but I have a relationship with the Bible, one that, this is an old Harry Emerson Fosdick anecdote, but he said, I don't take the Bible literally, I take it seriously. And that's a much different approach. And a lot of people bring their dogma and their doctrine to the reading of the text, and it compromises their seeing what is actually there in front of them. You know, this being worldwide brings to mind that one of the people I had a chance to meet and have grown to revere over the years is a New Zealander, a Kiwi named Lloyd Gearing. You've interviewed Lloyd when he was here in Phoenix a number of years ago. He just had his 100th birthday and is still going strong. But he is my role model for having, back in the 1960s, he's referred to as the last Western heretic, having said in his one of his classes what we're talking about today, saying, you know, if believing in a physical resurrection is important for your faith journey, that's great. But for a lot of us, we're at a point where believing in the resurrection as a metaphor is much more helpful for us in our spiritual journey. And for having even suggested that in a public place in a classroom, he was brought up on heresy charges by the Presbyterian Church in New Zealand. And it was a widely publicized trial. It was a heresy trial, which just don't happen very often. After the evidence was all presented, he was acquitted of being a heretic and later knighted by the government of New Zealand.
So. And he got to be 100.
And he got to be on your show. So
the absolute peak of his career,
exactly.
I'm sure.
So, but Lloyd is one of those people that has been one of the, and I can't even say vanguard. He's just been, of his generation through the 1930s into the 60s and 70s, was one of the people that was saying what I'm saying now. People keep thinking that it's something new, but it's not new. It's been a part of the conversation among people who take the Bible seriously for hundreds and hundreds of years, for generations. And so people get worked up like it's some sort of new threat to Christianity. And actually what I've found is that more people that I run into are interested in talking about an open-minded Christianity that takes into account our 21st century mindset is much more attractive than the Christianity that they grew up with.
Okay, David Felton's on The God Show, and I'm Pat McMahon, and we're talking on this Easter Sunday about that which I thought would be an interesting approach to Easter and Sunday and all of the things that we have associated with that highly respected Christian holiday and recognition of what most Christians seem to feel comfortable with, and that is the resurrection. And if that didn't happen, David, you are a student of the Bible, even if you don't take it literally. So you must have arrived, as the years have gone by, with congregations and with biblical study, you must have arrived at your own conclusion of what happened that day.
It's really hard for anybody to say that anything in particular happened. One of the people that we've interviewed as part of our Living the Questions program is Bernard Brandon Scott, and he's a professor of New Testament theology at Phillips in Tulsa. And he has a book called The Trouble with Resurrection. And he goes through, and I would really recommend picking up the book because it's a great outline of how difficult it is to try and say that any one thing happened on this Easter morning. And so he's also a huge movie fan and talks about how movies are the contemporary parables of our day, and that how short-sighted it would be to go in to watch a movie and always be thinking, oh, well, this is exactly the way it happened. I mean, we go in and to a movie and we are open to it being an interpretive experience, and we each afterwards talk about what that meant to us and how we thought it was going. And I think that's the gift that we really need to give one another when we're talking about Easter. You know, John Dominic Crossan says that when he's talking with people who are at odds with one another over whether something in the Bible happened or not, he says, let's just talk to one another, whether it happened historically or not, let's talk about what it means for you and what it means for me. Let's leave the argument aside as to whether it happened or not.
And I thank you very much for mentioning another guest of the God Show,
hey,
John
Dominic
Crossan.
We try to fix you up. So.
Okay, but when you're talking about the symbolism of a resurrection or the metaphorical description of those kinds of things happening or not happening literally, we are told, Christians anyway, are told that there will be a resurrection of us,
mm-hmm.
The resurrection of the dead. Does that mean we have to give up on that?
Beam me up, Scotty, right? I mean, that's not what it's about. It's not about being transported to some other dimension. But that seems to have been what has become important for a lot of Christians. And I think that, you know, two things. One is it says something about where people are at in their processing of their spiritual lives when the only reason that they're a Christian and the only reason that they decide to try and be good, with air quotes, is that they then have a chance to go to heaven because there's a threat of going to hell if you don't believe certain things. And so that is a real five-year-old kind of rationale for being good, because if you're not good, you get punished. And if you are good, then you get this reward.
But it is kind of a motivation. You know, I don't want to go to hell. I don't want to go to Newark either. But from the standpoint of the reward at the end of a life, that seems to be something that...
But what happens is when people make it all about something that's happening off in the distant future,
mm-hmm.
they stop concentrating on the here and now.
Here and now is Easter Sunday. Are we supposed to dismiss the entire concept?
No, but if we go back to... there's a great Methodist psychologist and pastor named James Fowler, who a number of years ago created a guide for us that included stages of faith. I mean, you think about as we grow physically, we go through different stages from being an infant to a toddler to a teenager to an adult to elderly. We have those all very well kind of set out in our own minds. And every one of those stages is different for each person. But pretty much we all go through them, and we go through them sequentially. You can't jump around from one to the other. Fowler said, we do the same thing psychologically. We do the same thing spiritually. And he said, in the first stage of faith, everything is very magical. You believe everything that you're, this is when you're a toddler. You believe everything your parents say or whoever is in charge of you says, you go with that as the word. And then you grow up a little bit more in the second stage, and that's when you start, you know, hearing some of the conventional wisdom around you, and you start buying into that as the way the world is. And then you enter a third stage, which is the stage that most people spend the rest of their lives in, which is kind of a conventional thinking on spirituality and how you interact with the world. So it's all about the status quo. It's all about embracing the values of your culture or your faith tradition. And you know that you want to embrace those because you want to fit in. But there's a fourth stage, and that's called critical thinking. A lot of people enter into that in college. That's why we lose a lot of college kids from churches, because they get to college, they're exposed to the rest of the world and other ways of thinking, and they look back and say, wow, somebody wasn't honest with me about the way the world is, and they kept me in this bubble. And so some people will never return to church or to a tradition of faith at all once they've been into that critical thinking stage, because they see it as going backwards. Other people spend their whole life in that critical thinking stage, and that's a way to be. But there's a fifth stage, and that is what Marcus Borg would call post-critical naivete, where you return to seeing the value of the stories that you embraced in stage three, but more in a metaphorical way. And you can see what they're trying to get at without being bogged down by having to believe that they actually happened.
But without those stories, David, without the stories that you bought at some time in your life,
yep. mm-hmm.
that found you attracted to the ministry,
mm-hmm.
without that, where is the wonder? Where is the glory? Where is the grandeur of a church, of a religion, of a Messiah that causes millions upon millions of people to be motivated to do good?
So you don't like poetry, or you don't get it?
What has that got to do with it?
Well, you don't like art, go to museums, you don't like anything that has to do with inspiring you to greater understanding of the world, to appreciate beauty, to appreciate an amazing turn of phrase in a poem or in good writing. And I think that's what we're missing, is that I would think I'm in stage five, more or less. There is a stage six. That's Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, that's when you reach this kind of universal space in the way you look at the world. But when you get to a point where you can appreciate the stories as being beautiful works of art that have powerful messages to convey to us, then there's every bit as much awe and wonder, if not more. I think that's one of the reasons why so many people are fascinated by what's called big history now. And as we start seeing our lives as human beings, basically being the last, 8 or 10,000 years of creation that goes back 14 billion years. And when you start looking at the amazing events that have transpired to bring us to this moment, that's when I start to feel I feel the same kind of awe about that I think a lot of people feel about, really believing as hard as they can in a physical resurrection. I just think that there's a different level of awe and wonder. And I think that's, people get irritated at me because I bring up Fowler's stages of faith, and they say, oh, well, of course you're five, you're level five. You're so much better than me. I'm just in level three. And I'm like, no, it's not judgmental. It's not saying that when you become a better Christian, you're in another stage. It's just acknowledging a reality that people are in different places in their spiritual lives, and that some people never get out of stage three, and that's okay. That's where they are. But don't begrudge me having gone through stage four and stage five, and now I'm in a different place. Don't tell me that I am not a good Christian based on your criteria.
You think Martin Luther King was stage six?
Oh, absolutely.
Then do you think that he believed in miracles, or did he dismiss those as just attractive myths?
I have no idea what he would have said, but my
guess,
my gut feeling is that he would have said that they are metaphor. Seeing that both of us went to Boston University School of Theology, thank you very much. Little plug for for BU.
They're still going to write to you for money.
Oh, they do. I think he was at a different place, and he, like Gandhi and like so many others in that stage, I think are not so much about what you believe as to what you do. And I think that's one of the big differences between folks who are more traditional or conventional in their Christian understanding than people who have moved on to a different place. Because Jesus, I really believe, Jesus could not give a rip what you believe. He was more about, show me. I mean, John Wesley, who is the founder of our denomination, the United Methodist and Wesleyan tradition, he said, don't tell me what you believe unless you can tell me how you get there. Tell me what your thought process was to get you to this point. And I think that in Jesus' case, the Gospels show over and over again how Jesus asked people to do things, asked them to change the way they were living. He didn't have a long list of doctrines that you had to believe. In fact, you talk about the creeds that many of us recite on Sundays. And, the United Methodist Church, as much as United Methodists are shocked to hear this, we are not a creedal church. John Wesley actually took the creeds out of our articles of religion because he was afraid people would take them literally. And so you look at the creeds and where they came out of in the fourth century and go back to Jesus and look at his kind of penultimate expression of what he thought being a person of faith was about. It's called the Beatitudes, and he talked about being merciful, about being peacemakers, and about being, all these things that we aspire to, not a single word about what to believe. Nothing. It was all about what to do. Well, fast forward 300 years to when the creeds were being written, and what does it say? Jesus was born of a virgin, comma, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. Where is Jesus' life? Where is his teaching? It's all just in that comma, that little blob of ink. So the creeds basically just discredited all of Jesus' teachings and his life and his example and made it all about what to believe and not a thing about what we need to do. And it's been downhill since then as a tradition.
Okay, so you were talking just a few minutes ago about the grandeur and the glory, the miracle, if you will, of great art, and the expression in the world of mankind of creativity and creation.
Let me just tell you a quick story. Let me derail your direction here and come back to a story about art.
Do you remember when I used to be the host of the show? I bring this back after all these years of total anonymity on his part. And no, please go ahead.
But I think it will help flesh out your where I think you're going with
the
question.
I need flushing.
Yeah. So, again, back to channeling John Dominic Crossan. He talks about this in a way that I think is really helpful for us to visualize, and says, just imagine, Abraham Lincoln High School somewhere in the Midwest. Imagine a beautiful colonnaded facade, a street running up to a beautiful tree-lined street, and you walk up to the front of the school, and on the lawn there in front of the colonnade, it says Lincoln High School, there is a beautiful statue of Lumberjack Lincoln. And on this statue, Lincoln is standing with both feet on either side of a tree stump, and he's got his axe raised above his head, and he's clearly about to come down onto the tree stump. And on the other side of the tree stump is an African-American slave who has got his chains from his wrists stretched out across that trunk. And he's looking up in anticipation that Lincoln is going to come down with his axe and shatter those chains and free him. So the question is, did that happen? And the answer is no. But is it true? And the answer is, yeah, absolutely it's true. And in that, you have an example of what the Gospels are all on about. And that is, did they happen? Maybe not. But are they true? Absolutely. They come with a level and depth of meaning that that I think art, be it poetry or sculpture or any number of other things, also bring out of us. When we see something beautiful, when we read something, when we are exposed to something that just causes us to stop and gawk because of its challenge to us, or because of its just unutterable beauty.
And even though that sculpture, that statue of Lincoln may not in fact exist, there are certainly plenty of them around. The art on our currency, $5 bills, that's a portrait of Lincoln. I'd like to know from you, on Sundays, what kind of portrait of Jesus you present to your congregation. Who was that guy?
Well, one of the things I try to emphasize, and it's amazing how often I have to emphasize it to remind people, is that Jesus was a Jew. He wasn't the first Christian. And as far as the Gospels are concerned, doesn't set out to create a new religion at all. And in fact, Christianity has really done a yeoman's work to try and de-Jewify Jesus. You know, a perfect example is last week with Palm Sunday and last week with Holy Week. We have a lot of examples in the Passion story where Jews are portrayed in a very malicious, bad light. And it is in a lot of ways the source of anti-Semitism that we've suffered throughout the millennia because, you know, the Jews killed Jesus and all of this kind of thing. But when you go back and actually look at the text, actually it was the Romans that killed Jesus and not the Jews. And when you go back a little further and look at the historical context, you realize that after the destruction of the temple in 70 of the Common Era, there was a little competition between two kinds of Judaism. One was what has become rabbinic Judaism, and the other one was Jewish followers of Jesus, who had not completely made the break from Judaism yet. And so you basically had out-and-out competition for followers. And, okay, how are you going to do that? Well, human nature being what it is, you discredit your competitor. And so the Jewish followers of Jesus, who became the Christians, started to portray the rabbinic Jews as malicious and as evil and as the ones who killed Jesus. And that is what got picked up, because that started to happen early on, and that got picked up by the Gospels. And so the Gospels are infected with this anti-Semitism that was born of competition between who was going to survive. And so I really try to make an effort to dial that back and talk about Jesus' Judaism and say that guy did not come up with a lot of crazy stuff out of thin air. You look at what he talked about, his whole life, his whole ministry was, you could sum up in Micah 6:8, which, you know, the prophets, among the prophets who said, you need to, you know, love kindness. You need to practice justice. You need to walk humbly with your God. And when, you know, people trying to catch Jesus out said, hey, what's the greatest commandment? And what did Jesus do? He quoted Deuteronomy. He went to his own tradition and said, you need to love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. Oh, and another, it's like it. You need to love your neighbor as yourself. And I just think that that is the way that we need to be portraying Jesus, is a part of a great tradition of which we now as Christians are a part. And it's going to be every bit as much a challenge to live in the way that Jesus called us to live as it is to have to believe these things. What did the Queen of Hearts say? She has to believe six unbelievable things before breakfast, right? And that seems to be what a lot of churches are requiring of people.
Queen of Hearts also said, off with his head. And a number of people are saying that around the world right now about you, David, because you're upsetting a number of people whose parents have celebrated Easter as the celebration of the miracle of the resurrection, whose grandparents did. And so I'm saying the traditionalists who are not necessarily evangelical and perhaps
just conventional,
logically,
yeah.
But logically they also have been shown a number of questionable arguments in the Bible among the Gospels. But those traditionalists who are listening right now, who totally believe that the resurrection took place as we have been taught in Christianity all this time, do you consider those people stupid?
No, they're just in a different place. I mean, I was in that place when I was younger, and as I've grown and studied and considered and been in conversation with people who I trust and been exposed to new ways of seeing the Gospels, I've moved to a different place. And so, again,
I come
back.
Is it a better place? A more intelligent place?
It's a better place for me, because if I was forced to stay in that earlier manifestation of Christianity, I would have checked out long ago. And so being where I'm at right now and being able to help other people come to that conclusion allows me to continue to embrace Jesus as the one whom I follow without having to suspend disbelief on a lot of these other things.
There are some folks who are also listening in different parts of the world to this broadcast of The God Show who are interested in what you've been saying, and they're curious. They have not necessarily bought in to the Book of Felton, but they just simply are curious about learning more. What volume or volumes would you recommend that they read now to at least consider some of the things that you've said?
Well, I think if we're talking about the Passion and Holy Week and Easter, you might consider looking at John Dominic Crossan and Marcus Borg. They have several books, one of which is The Last Week, which in detail goes through and discusses all of these various things we've been talking about today. And that's pretty much what is taught in academia. I'd also encourage people to look at things like Bishop Jack Spong's books.
Another guest of the God Show.
Another guest of the God Show. One of his books is, one of his classics, I guess, would be Rescuing the Bible from Fundamentalism, which helps walk people through this experience. And his newest book is called Unbelievable, and that just is coming out just this month. And it's a wonderful summation of a lot of the things that we've been talking about today. And I would encourage people to check out Unbelievable by Jack Spong.
Yes, and I believe he was the bishop of the Diocese of New Jersey, right?
Yeah, of Newark. But let me just finish with one more thing, too, a recommendation.
The second time Newark has been mentioned on the show, and it's got to stop.
We're getting kickbacks. So the other book that I would really recommend that people read is this thing called the Bible. I think that if we want to really talk seriously about some of the things that we've been chatting about today, it behooves people to look at the original text. And it seems like when you're talking about things like the resurrection or any number of other things that are controversial in the Bible, it seems as if one of the expectations in the conversation is that you steadfastly resolve to not read the Bible. Because if you do, it's going to raise questions. And that's the last thing that a lot of people want to do. They just want to go along and think about it the way they've always thought about it and not refer to the actual text or connect them together or see how they reflect on one another. So that would probably be the primary text that I would encourage people to read, especially at this time of year. Go check out those gospel stories and
if
see
I,
how different they are.
If I, though, accept the fact that the resurrection is a nice story that carries the Jesus story and life on a little further. Without the resurrection, how can I call myself a Christian?
Well, I don't think that I am calling myself a Christian or a follower of Jesus without the resurrection. I still talk about the resurrection, but I talk about it in all of the different ways that it can be expressed beyond just a physical resurrection. And again, I'll appeal to Paul and say, look, I mean, he said, you fool, when he was yelling at the Corinthians about this. He said, it's not a it's sown a physical body, but it's raised a spiritual body. Okay, let's talk about that. What does that mean? And even the gospel writers don't agree. You know, when in the John portrayal of it, Mary comes to the garden to see Jesus and mistakes him for a gardener and goes to embrace him, and he says, "Don't touch me. Don't cling to me." Right? In Luke, we've got the example of Jesus appearing seemingly out of thin air or disappearing in thin air. So that's kind of a spirity kind of portrayal. But he also says, oh no, look, I'm hungry. You know, so he wants to eat something to show that he's a physical body. So even the gospel writers portray Jesus in different ways. The thing we need to talk about again is, what does the resurrection mean for us? How does it inspire us? How do we embody the resurrection in our lives? And there are so many examples of ways. I mean, you know, it's preached all the time about, you know, what is your stone that needs to be rolled away? Is it, you know, depression, or is it struggling with addiction, or any number of other things that we have in our lives? And there are great ways to approach interpreting the resurrection in ways that are transformative, that lead to reconciliation in broken relationships, that bring people to a different place, to new life. It's like they have been born anew. And that's the way I embrace resurrection as a metaphor, as a way of life right now.
Do you think Pope Francis is inspirational?
Absolutely. And he's right with me on this, by the way.
Really?
I would say that.
How do you, now, wait just a second. Have you had an audience with the Pope?
We had a coffee one Thursday afternoon. No. You know, the thing that people don't realize is that those of us who are ordained in the mainline tradition and in the Roman Catholic tradition have all been exposed to this historical critical way of interpreting the Bible. It's been something that's being taught in our seminaries across the board for well over 100 years now, going on 150 years. And the question is to ask is, why aren't more clergy, right on up to the Pope himself, talking about these kind of things? Because it helps people get up to speed on where the conversation is among those people who dedicate their entire lives to studying the Bible. I was really thrilled a couple weeks ago. The Fountains celebrated its 30th anniversary as a United Methodist Church, and our bishop, Bob Hoshibata, came out to speak. And I was really glad, you know, that he started out his message by saying, okay, our passage today is from Colossians, and it says, you know, Paul's letter to the Colossians, but we know that it really wasn't written by Paul. You know, the language in the letter is not what we're familiar with from the authentic Paul. The topics are different, but that doesn't mean that the letter doesn't have some good things for us to take away. So even though it's not Paul, let's really dig into this. And I think even that very small gesture of acknowledging to people that, hey, your Bible says the letter of Paul to the Colossians. And now you've got a bishop saying, well, actually, that the letter of Paul bit is not actually accurate. That causes people to go, hang on a second. Wait, what are you talking about? Two Pauls? Three Pauls? And that helps the conversation along and helps people to break out of their very narrow idea of the Bible and its origins having been, you know, out of a thundercloud floating down out of heaven into the hands of a, you know, a shepherd boy in the Holy Land who happened to read Elizabethan English. People have strange ideas about where things come from.
What do you think, though, considering the fact that we've now spent nearly an hour talking about Christianity exclusively, what about the inspiration of someone like the Dalai Lama? Do you think that the Dalai Lama dismisses these stories also as myth?
Well, don't mishear me. I'm not dismissing them as myth. And I don't think the Dalai Lama would dismiss them as myth. I don't think that my rabbinical friends would dismiss them as myth. They would embrace them for what they are and celebrate them as metaphor. And you know, it's just hard for me to go back now and think about them as literal events because they just don't have the same power for me as a literal event. And I think about, you know, my kids are totally addicted to Hamilton. They have the whole thing memorized. And, you know, now my 18-year-old is reading the Chernow biography and just, you know, pouring over every detail. And of course, you can't get every detail of a 1,000-page biography into a 2-hour musical. And yet, Lin-Manuel Miranda has the poetic talent and the musical talent to be able to distill all this down into an incredibly moving story that gets across some of the main ideas that are totally inspirational and have engaged my kids in a hunger for American history that I never thought I would see.
With only a couple of minutes left, when I was a child, Easter to me also meant going to the nest, and I've never understood why it is that this would be linked to the life of Jesus, but I'd be looking for candy, bunnies, and chickens. With 1 minute to go, give us an Easter surprise that we can live with.
Wow, an Easter surprise. I would say an Easter surprise would be for people to go beyond the, I think, more simplistic idea of believing in a physical resurrection into an understanding of the resurrection as something that frees them from the things that burden them right now and that liberates them to live their lives here and now and not get caught up in being satisfied with just something that happened thousands of years ago, but something that they can live out today.
And when you are listening to this broadcast, this beginning of what I hope will be a long relationship, that is, you and me, wherever you are in the world, I hope that you'll understand that the God Show is here simply to ask questions, and perhaps some of the answers should come from you. If that's true, get in touch with us always, every single Sunday, and then through the rest of the week, every minute that the God Show is available to you on the Star Worldwide Networks. StarWorldwideNetworks.com. I'm Pat McMahon, and I'd love to hear your questions, and I'll pass them on to our guests. Thank you for being with us.